Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a markets reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week, we'll discuss how the Federal Reserve signaled it may be ready to lower interest rates. That helped send the S&P 500 to an intraday record, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the risks are gone. Rather, the G20 meeting is next week, and now there's actually concerns over a real war with Iran after a U.S. drone was shot down. Meanwhile, the March of the Unicorns continues with Slack Technologies making its triumphant debut on Wall Street.
And our guests will help us sort all of that out. And of course, we'll finish with our tradition, the craziest thing I ever saw in markets this week. Sarah, I'm assuming you're prepared.
As always.
Oh, good. Well, our two guests, Sarah, today, I don't know if you realize, but they both remind me of my days over on Bloomberg Opinion. Well, it was called Gadfly back then. And this is back when I was licensed and accredited to actually have opinions in this company.
Which, I'm not allowed to do that.
You're no longer allowed to have opinions.
No.
And I'll tell you, having opinions is harder than it sounds. I mean, it's one thing to call up someone and get his opinions on the market. And then if he's wrong, it's his problem. You can move on. But when you have to have them yourself, it's actually pretty intimidating. But our first guest here, Julian Emmanuel of BTIG, the Chief Equity and Derivatives Strategist. Welcome to the show, Julian.
Great to be here.
And Julian, now, when I used to have opinions, I can assure you they were all valid, serious opinions, except on Fridays when I went off my meds. And one week, the story I wrote about was a Bloomberg story about how J. Crew had widened neckties by a quarter inch.
Okay.
And that made me think we have to do a league table of the best dressed men on Wall Street to find out how wide their neckties were.
And you did.
And I did. And I'll tell you, some of our friends in Bloomberg did not perform well in this league table.
Sad.
John Farrow was at the bottom at about 2.25.
I'll bring that up with him.
Yeah,
see if absolutely. He's improved.
Luke Kawa was near the bottom at 2.25. Julian, I'm proud to say, was right in the middle, which I think is where you want to be in this particular league table. Three and a quarter.
I got to call you out on that one, Mike, because basically a couple years ago I was on with Keen, and Tom looked at me and said, "That is a beautiful 1995 Brooks Brothers suit." So don't know about that.
I'm not even sure if you voluntarily participated or if I just hijacked you with a ruler after you came off TV or something. I can't remember.
Yeah. How do you even get? I'm surprised you got so many people to participate.
He was right in the middle.
Props.
And I think that is the sweet spot, right at near the national benchmark average. You don't want to be in the tail of this bell curve at all. But also from Bloomberg Opinion, my old pal Shira Ovadeh, who covers all things technology and whatnot. I'm sure can probably explain that maybe that necktie story is why I'm no longer allowed to have opinions at Bloomberg.
Disagree. We need more necktie content on Bloomberg Opinion.
I was hoping someone would refresh that league table once a year, but no luck. No luck.
Can you imagine if they assigned it to an intern or someone new? Make sure that they track every single person down and measure their neckties.
I have to admit that I am looking at your necktie right now, Mike, to see how wide it is.
It's a little wide, a little wide.
But anyway.
Yeah.
From neckties to Fed, I don't really know how to make that a truly smooth transition. If anyone has ideas, shout, let me know. But Julian, I want to come to you because everyone was talking about before the Fed meeting on Wednesday, the statement that it was going to be so difficult for them to truly out-dove the markets. But it seems like they did. I mean, is that truly what happened here?
That is definitely part of it. And I have to say, I'll give you the transition here. Chair Powell's necktie at the press conference was about as tight as it could possibly have been.
Wow.
Given the tweets of the previous 48 hours. you know, from our point of view, we actually expected that the Fed might disappoint given the dovish expectations. But Chair Powell really did come through, and you can see it in the market. pricing in really 100% chance of a 25 basis point cut at the July meeting, and actually almost a 25% chance mm-hmm. of a 50 basis point cut. So the markets definitely did like it. But importantly, the Fed liked the market's reaction to what it said.
Right. But last I read from you, you're actually thinking it won't come until September, that first cut, and then maybe another in December. Is that still your thinking after this week's performance by Powell?
We're sticking with that, although clearly the odds have skewed the potential for July. But if you think about the sort of quandary that the Fed chair is in, if you wait till September, particularly given the market's positive reaction over the last several days, and what we think could be positive news coming out of G20 in the next week and a half or so, the asset markets are perhaps giving the Fed the time to wait. And if you think about it again, from this challenge of the tight necktie with regard to political independence, waiting past July sends a message that the Fed is independent of the White House, number one, and importantly, actually, is independent of what the market is trying to force them to do, with the knowledge that you could still go in September and continue apace.
So there are many people who say that if we don't get a rate cut now in July, because it is so highly expected, that we are going to see pretty much a fit from the market. Well, your guys' price target, I know for your end, is still around 3,000. How is it that you guys see the potential for the Fed to not cut in July, but stocks to really still hang in there and potentially move much higher?
Well, you know, setting a new all-time high this week, at least on an intraday basis, as we have, we're pretty darn close to that 3,000.
Right.
So, you know, happily so, of course. But in that respect, it really is a case of, you know, whether you measure it in terms of financial conditions, and the Bloomberg Financial Conditions Index is really a very valuable tool, and that is reasonably loose compared to the last year and a half or so. The Fed actually has the leeway, and if the market walks back its own expectations, particularly if you get good news from Trump and Xi, and remember, we've also got earnings season reporting starting in the middle of July, which mm-hmm. tends to be a tailwind for stocks in general. You still get the 3,000.
Now, what does good news at the G20 look like? Is it a handshake and a letter to keep talking? Obviously, they're not going to presumably have a deal signed, sealed, and delivered between the U.S. and China there. What would sort of, you know, define good news to you at the G20?
Well, I think it's smiles after the steak dinner, red wine for Xi, and Diet Coke for President Trump, as appears to be the case.
Yeah.
But for us, if you look at financial markets over the last several years, whatever the quandary's been, Brexit, debt ceiling, China, whatever it is, if you're able to successfully, call it, kick the can down the road mm-hmm. and leave mm-hmm. markets optimistic that you're going to get an eventual dissolution to whatever it is, that's going to be enough. And we think that's the case here, particularly since in the last 48 hours, it's very clear that North Korea is on the table as well.
When it comes to a trade deal versus a Fed cut, say you can only get one or another, which is actually more valuable for the stock market? I mean, in a way, can you make the case that maybe a deal at the G20 or really a positive outcome there isn't the greatest outcome, because then maybe the Fed takes that away and they start to see economic data turn around, really start to tighten up, toughen up, and the Fed decides that they're not going to cut? The data doesn't imply it.
Well, so we give Chairman Powell a lot of credit for pivoting as quickly as he did in January from tightening to neutral. But the way this week has sorted itself out, we are in easing mode, whether we actually get the cuts or they're delayed. And so, you know, we don't expect a repivot back to neutral or tightening. In that respect, the trade deal is really very important, because if you look at the last year, and the cause of the Fed's concern, it's been inflation being too low. And one of the mistakes the Fed made last year in tightening, we think they over-tightened and shouldn't have tightened in December, was in assuming that a trade war was going to be inflationary. And in fact, it's proven to be disinflationary by leaps and bounds.
Now, Julian, your business card says chief equity and derivatives strategist. So I want to ask you about the derivatives end a little bit. You know, I've noticed the VIX has sort of flattened out here at about 15 or so during June. We're not getting back to those single-digit readings on implied volatility as far as the VIX goes. Is there any information in that to you? I mean, is it just sort of embedded nervousness until all these issues are resolved, or what? I mean, are those days of single-digit VIX just gone forever?
Gone. Forget about them. We traded below 9 at the end of 2017, and when we began our coverage at BTIG in January of 18, we made the point that that was a turning point in what we saw as a six-year cyclical regime change in volatility. And so obviously the spikes that we saw throughout 2018 and then again in early this year, to us, make sense. They're logical. And when you think about it with respect to the political risks that are building as the world really redraws itself in terms of trade and relationships and so on, it makes a lot of sense. And what it also tells you, it's a reminder that while things seem good now, and we do think that there is enough good news out there to potentially to carry markets, perhaps even beyond 3,000, we're still going to have to deal with the debt ceiling and a budget battle in the fall. And Brexit, the thing, the gift that keeps on giving, is going to be there.
Yep. Waiting for Halloween.
Exactly.
October 31st.
Exactly.
What about the divergence that we've seen, though, between volatility in the bond market and volatility in the stock market? Because I know if you use the MOVE Index from Bank of America as a sort of benchmark for bond market volatility, we have seen such a spike in recent weeks. And now we have the 10-year dipping below 2% for the first time in 2016. Yet the VIX is still very muted. I mean, do you make the case that we will have to see a convergence, the two come together? And if so, I mean, does the VIX move higher or does bond volatility finally start to settle down a little?
We think there will be a convergence, probably in the guise of bond market volatility coming in and the VIX rising. A lot of the activity in financial markets over the last year has been about positioning. So when we got to the end of March and German yields first went back to the negative bound, mm-hmm. which, you know, to all of us financial professionals with any gray hair is almost completely inconceivable. There was an initial panic. But then in April, as markets sort of turned better and yield stabilized, there was a thought that you wouldn't have the U.S. 10-year yield go back to 2%. Well, that sort of went out the window the last few weeks. I mean, honestly, we didn't see yields plunging to this depth. But then again, we didn't see German yields trading to minus 30 basis points. And that caused what we call in the options market a short gamma squeeze. Basically, people had been selling sort of those downside strikes and really short exposure in that area. And once you got to around 2%, the vol started to build. We think ultimately, in fact, as the Fed loosens policy at the short end, builds inflation expectations, that you actually have a rise in the long end, i.e. a steepening yield curve. And that's part of the happiness of the last several days, if you're Jay Powell, because inflation expectations were the first thing to ratchet higher post the FOMC conference.
Now, given what you're expecting, some good news at the G20, an eventual monetary easing later in the year, what sort of sectors, stocks, would it be your traditional cyclical, industrials, semiconductors, or, you know, our tech columnist here, Shira, should she start writing about utilities instead? What, you know, how should we position?
The new momentum. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, having been doing this for quite some time, I never thought I'd use the phrase momentum darling when referring to utilities. I mean, again, going back to the 90s and trading technology on the way up, it's absolutely extraordinary. From our point of view, this is the part of the cycle, particularly given our view that the yield curve is going to steepen, that you want to lean a bit more cyclically oriented. And that means financials, which have been suppressed because, again, German yields and the yield curve being as flat as it's been. Also, energy. Obviously, energy has a geopolitical backstop at this point, given the tension in Iran. But it's also sunk to less than 5% of the weight of the S&P 500. And we are true believers in autonomous driving and electric vehicles and all that. But energy is still a story that in the medium term looks very interesting to us, and it's a sector that's poised for consolidation.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Shira, I want to come to you because we did have a new IPO or direct listing, as we could call it, this week, but start a little broader on the tech front because software companies are just trading at such high valuations. I know software is the best performing industry in the S&P 500. What is it about this market right now that is just making investors so interested in the software space?
I think it's a particular type of software companies that investors are really excited about, these sort of software as a service or B2B software, cloud software companies, however you want to describe them. But these are companies that investors have fallen in love with kind of to the point of mania. We're talking about companies like Workday or Salesforce or Veeva Systems, which makes pharmaceutical software. And I think the appeal here is these companies sell an understood product. They sell software for money to companies that have money. And there's kind of a repeat business, right? It's a subscription basis. The companies are paying, you know, monthly or on an annual basis. And it's sort of fairly easy to model out what the revenue model and what the financial model looks like long term once you get companies paying kind of a recurring subscription for software. And so what you've seen is these companies have, you know, for the most part, do not have profits, but they do have revenue and free cash flow in some cases and are trading at very, very high multiples to revenue in particular.
Now, sure, let's pretend I'm not the young hipster tech savvy guy that I am.
Because we all know you are.
Just imagine, I don't know, I'm a middle-aged dad.
Talking about the width of your necktie.
That's right. You're more of a Jonathan Farrow kind of skinny tie guy.
Hypothetical situation. Let's say, hypothetically, I've never heard of this Slack Technologies. I'm not quite sure what they do, but I do know they lost $139 million last year on sales of about $400 million. Just walk us through what Slack is and why investors seem to be excited to buy a company that's losing more than a quarter of their sales.
I will tell you that my tech journalist brain is now broken where I see a company that's like, oh, they're only bleeding $100 million in cash every year.
Nothing.
That sounds great. Sign me up. So the basic explanation of Slack is it's instant messaging designed for the workplace. And I think that undersells it a little bit. And Slack, I think, has this issue where it is a little bit difficult to describe their software until you really use it. But again, it's instant messaging. And the idea is that it kind of collects, you're able to kind of organize multiple people's inboxes, essentially, in a semi-public way that you can organize groups or teams, and then everything that's related to, let's say, some marketing project that a team is working on will go into one channel, as Slack calls it. And only the people who are on that channel need to see it. So it avoids the sort of reply all pain that we have sometimes felt inside of companies. And, you know, it also does a good job of kind of connecting to other systems. So I know companies, for example, that all of the customer service requests or complaints, no matter what channel it's coming from, if it's like an angry tweet or an instant message that a customer might send through a company's website, it all gets sent and kind of distributed through Slack so that people on the East Coast, let's say, will see all of the messages no matter where it's coming from, customer service complaints from the coast that they live on. So it is a clever piece of software. I think there are open questions about whether it is a kind of nice to have software for companies or whether it becomes an essential tool inside of a modern office. But definitely it's good software that now investors are over the moon about.
And on that subscription basis that you're talking
about? On that
about.
Subscription basis, yes. And they say they have 10 million people who use it on a daily basis inside of organizations, and something like 600,000 kind of paying customers, paying organizations.
How can you print out all these chats and give them to a guy like me to read? Is that...
Interesting. I've never noticed if there there's probably a print option. Do not do that, however. Do not print your Slack chats.
But so you talk about the subscription model, but how are investors actually going about valuing a company of this sort, especially if, like you said, they are losing money like many of the other tech IPOs that we've seen lately?
I mean, I think the metrics that have become important are looking at sort of recurring revenue, sort of, you know, how much money is repeatable business, and also looking ahead at billing. So basically booked business that is not yet paid. So really growth and revenue and kind of retention rates of existing customers, those are the metrics that people look at in the absence of, you know, conventional GAAP profits.
Another column you had that caught my eye, the headline was something like, who knows what lurks in the emails of tech executives? You know, obviously with the antitrust scrutiny coming up on Facebook, Amazon, Google, is this the right time for Facebook to be trying to revolutionize the payment system with its own cryptocurrency?
You're saying this is not a time they will want to attract more attention from regulators at Facebook?
Exactly.
Yeah, fair enough. Look, I've heard Mark Zuckerberg say a few times now in the last couple of years that they can't stop running the company and they can't stop coming out with new products and ideas because of the scrutiny they're under, which I think is true and also not true, right? They obviously want to be a little bit more cautious and careful than they would have been prior to 2006 or 2016 or 2015. But they, you know, you got to keep innovating. That's the role of a tech company.
Yeah, Julian, how do you think about this regulatory risk with a group as important as the FANG stocks? I mean, does it make you sort of want to look elsewhere in the market, or are these still going to be the stocks that lead us higher?
Well, when we're looking at over the balance of this year and into an election year next year, we're neutral on the group. But, you know, if you look at the last 10, 20, 30 years, it's very clear the technology is the bull market. You know, we've done a lot of work that says markets can continue to go up, but technology can only underperform by a certain amount. So from our point of view, it's something we'd like to see it get further along in the election cycle. Valuations are reasonable broadly. And I would say, you know, again, when you're thinking about software in particular, it's that phrase recurring revenue that is literally music to the street's ears. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it like we do from an options perspective, if you have a company with recurring revenue, you can actually, there's like less volatility to its streams, so you can, in fact, pay more for that company.
What about the IPO market this year? I know if you look at the IPO ETF, it's having its best first half of the year pretty much ever. So is this something that you guys actually think about participating in, or is it just very risky and you need to wait until things kind of die down a little?
Well, BTIG's capital markets desk has been very, very busy, which is a great thing. And you know, we look at that to try and gauge signs of froth. We're nowhere near the excesses that we saw in 1999 and 2000. And if you think about it, part of the reason that the optics of it over the last several months have been as busy as they've been is because you actually had a delay for the first several months of the year in getting the paperwork through because of the government shutdown. So it'll be interesting to see as we get into the heart of the summer whether there's going to be a slowdown or not. That'll be an important sign.
A slowdown in issuance or a slowdown in the price appreciation?
Slowdown in issuance. And if you look at it in terms of the price, there have been winners and losers. It's not all straight winners.
Right.
You know, it's and they differentiated, and it isn't necessarily technology only that's captured people's imaginations.
Well, Sarah, I'm looking at your stopwatch. Sarah keeps a stopwatch running.
It's very intimidating.
Yeah, it is.
Is it intimidating?
A little bit.
I just want to make sure that we don't go on for too long.
But that's our cue to get to the most important part of the podcast, which is the craziest thing I've seen in markets ever, or at least this week. Parentheses. We really haven't finalized that title of it yet. Julian, did they warn you about this? About this segment of ours?
They absolutely did.
He's always prepared.
We try. So from our point of view, this week has been a great example of artificial intelligence run wild. And as you know, part of the reason that you brought me here to join you is to talk about the Fed and interest rates, very important in terms of thinking about stock prices. Well, what we noticed was if you did a search for stories with the keyword yield curve into and through the FOMC press conference this week, we saw a massive spike in that story count. And from our point of view, it really is a big justification for why the yield curve steepened 9 basis points. That may not sound like a lot, but on something that was trading at 19 to go from 19 to 28, that's a huge move. So we don't know whether it was, you know, revenge of the nerds or return of the bond vigilantes, but we do know it's a big deal.
Sorry, it's illuminating how guys on the street use our work product here. We think they're reading
actually
our stories,
reading it,
and
counting.
Now they're just counting the words. And
good to know that you're really getting to the bottom of an 800-word
story.
It is. We can start messing with it. I'm just going to write a story that just goes yield curve, yield curve, yield curve.
You'll really mess with people.
Yeah, I'm not really going to do that. Sarah, have you seen any crazy market things this week?
So something I thought was interesting was in the aftermath of the Jerome Powell presser, we saw stocks rally, we saw bonds rally, we saw golds rally, and we saw oil rally all together. And I thought it was kind of funny. Macro risk advisors called it as cats and dogs playing together, basically, because on the one end, you think of bonds and gold being these safe havens, and then you think of stocks and oil being risk assets. But the reality is that now we have low interest rates. We also see the dollar falling at last. So we're just seeing pretty much a bid to everything, which is I thought was pretty crazy.
Rallying everything. I think that's an old Steve Martin reference, isn't it? The cats and dogs living together. Shira, we warned you about this gimmick we have here.
You did. I may have done it wrong, however. I read there was a story in the Wall Street Journal this week about Venezuela, the Venezuelan central bank basically smuggling 7 or 8 tons of gold to be melted down in Uganda and then resold secretly in the Middle East. Which is, I mean, it has everything, right? It's got, I'm just imagining 8 tons of gold on these Russian cargo planes being flown to Uganda in the middle of the night and then being trucked to some refinery and melted down.
So they concluded that it was...
That's what the Ugandan authorities said, that they believe that is what happened. That's a way of Venezuela basically getting cash by going around U.S. sanctions.
Didn't someone tell them they were probably better off trying to smuggle an ETF, much less visible?
And then you redeem it afterwards, and you have to find the vault where your gold is hidden?
Please suggest that to the Maduro government. Yes.
All right, well, mine, I'm stretching the definition of markets here a little bit, which I'm apt to do.
You
in
go
this
to art, you go to jewelry.
Right.
Oh, that was me.
This week I'm going. Yeah, that was you. This week I'm going to the gambling market. That's a real market, Julian, right?
Absolutely.
Sports. It's legal now. Sports betting in Jersey. I can't believe. I still can't believe it when I read this. But so, I'll just read the story, the lead of the story here from Eben Novi Williams of here at Bloomberg. The National Basketball Association has come up with a way for fans to gamble real money on fake games. Have you guys seen this story?
No.
So what happens is they basically splice together a bunch of clips from different basketball games and create a fake game out of it. Here, I'll read you the sort of the nut graph here. Bettors will be dropped into the final 90 seconds of a virtual matchup between two NBA teams. The game will then splice together random possessions from various Nets-Lakers games in recent... Do we not have enough things to gamble on, Julian? My
avatar is backing away from that very quickly, but I'll tell you one thing. You, with the exception of the last several weeks, you don't want to bet against Steph Curry.
The editors of that, whatever they are doing, splicing together different possessions, they've got to be talented. Match them up.
Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of done randomly. It almost sounds like it's just a computer program that takes various possessions, artificial intelligence. I don't know. I'll find something better to gamble on than that.
That's pretty crazy. I'll give it to you. Absolutely. But with that said, Julian Emanuel, Shira Ovide, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website, and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reganonymous. Our guest, Shira Ovide, is at Shira Ovide. And Bloomberg Podcast is at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.